Hello and welcome back, listeners of Lost Dimensions. Today we have another interview on the cards. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce Professor Akhil Ridhimar, who is a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law in both Yale College and Yale Law School. Professor Ridhimar is one of the most famous constitutional law scholars in the country, who's been widely cited in law journals and at the Supreme Court, and he is somebody who I have followed for several years now. It is my absolute honor and privilege to be talking to him today about his new book that recently came out, The Words That Made Us, which focuses on constitutional conversation at the founding. And with that, I'll let the interview begin. All right, welcome, Professor Ridhimar. When I start these interviews, I always ask, I like to ask the authors about what the purpose of the book is. So if I could briefly state in my own words, if I had to summarize the objective of The Words That Made Us, as described in the preface and postscript, I would say the book's purpose is to give somewhat of a panoramic, multi-generational account of constitutional conversation at the founding, and to do so with an opinionated gloss that is all too often missing from typical historical accounts. I would say this opinionated gloss is useful, needful, or dare I say necessary for legal considerations which emphasize applicability over overly intellectual abstractions. I would say the book works to make us remember and understand the context of our founding, to grow from its mistake and learn from its successes, and to continue on the perpetual American journey of E Pluribus Unum. And that founding story is truly what binds all Americans together. Is this a fair assessment of the work? And in your own words, could you briefly explain your book and the animating telos of the project that you embarked on?
It's an exceedingly fair assessment and a generous one, one that I think captures fully my intent. So thank you for that nice summary. I guess I should say one other thing on a personal note. This is about the words that made us. It's about the words that made the United States. And what is it that we Americans, have in common? And my claim is we don't have race in common. We are people of different races and ethnicities, and we don't have religion in common. We are a land of many faiths. But what we don't even fully have language in common. Not everyone speaks English, and even those who do don't speak it as don't all speak it as their native language. But what we do all have in common is this: the Constitution of the United States. That's what we have in common. We are a creedal people, a people who believe in certain propositions, and not just the ones set out in the Constitution, but Lincoln very famously talked about the Declaration of Independence as some of the propositions to which the nation is committed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, Jefferson said, and that all men are created equal. And Lincoln, riffing on that at Gettysburg, said 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So this is a book about the Constitution, which is what we have in common, and about the Declaration of Independence before it, and the Bill of Rights after it, and the larger conversations in which all these canonical texts are nested. And the one thing that I just wanted to confess at the beginning is I think I feel this particularly because I'm the first generation in my family to be born in the United States. So the we that I'm talking about are not all people who genetically descend from those who were involved in the founding project, but we can all be part of that. I believe I'm part of it. And I believe the Constitution made me part of it on the day that I was born, because it made me a citizen. And what I wanted to confess to you right out, just so we get it out of the way, is that I was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and not in Lansing, but I hope that's still okay.
Oh no, both of my parents went to Michigan actually, and I had been raised as a Michigan fan, so I won't harbor any of it against you. All
Okay. Well,
right,
thank you for that.
so getting right into the book, one of the first things that jumps out is you start the story in 1760 instead of typical accounts that start in 1763. So can you talk about what was so distinctive about the Paxton's case and the writs of assistance, and why that was where you jump in with this book?
There were two or three reasons that I began my book earlier than virtually every other book on the American Revolution, which, as you say, almost all start in 1763. That's the end of a war. The Seven Years' War is what it's called in the rest of the world. The French and Indian War is what Americans typically have called it. And in 1763, a war concludes with a formal treaty of peace, a treaty of Paris between Britain and France, in which France formally hands over Canada to the British. And the typical story starts in 1763. Okay, the Brits have won Canada, but now they have to pay for the war. The war was hugely expensive, and they try to do so by taxing Americans, who begin to push back with the Sugar Act and especially the Stamp Act to follow. So that's the standard story. And I start earlier. I start earlier in 1760 and 61, as you say, for three or four reasons. One is narrative, cinematographic. And I use that metaphor because it's act one, scene one of my movie. And what's the most interesting act one, scene one? It's the first time Harry met Sally, which is a movie. And the first time three people are in a room together, and these three are going to be three of the most important people during the next 15 years leading up to Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill and the Declaration of Independence. One of these guys is The will become the most famous loyalist in America. He's going to stay loyal to the crown, who is American born. And most people, even really smart history majors, wouldn't even know his name. Americans wouldn't have his name on the tip of their tongue. His name is Thomas Hutchinson. And I think readers should see who the best loyalist was because there's actually a conversation in America and some people on the other side. And if I had to analogize him to someone today, I'd pick someone who also, has Michigan connections. I'd say he's kind of like, excuse me, Mitt Romney. He's smart. He's decent. He's honest. He's a traditionalist. He's a conservative of sort, a certain sort. He probably believes in certain kinds of social hierarchies, but he's not a bad person. I happen to be a Democrat, but I respect Mitt Romney. He's a decent person. That's Thomas Hutchinson, and I want my readers to see the best of the loyalists in America. I got a second guy in the room. He also isn't a household name today, but he is a firebrand revolutionary. He will become the earliest big crusader on the Patriot side. He's Patrick Henry before there's Patrick Henry, and he's not a Virginian. He's a Massachusetts guy. He's this crusading lawyer. His name is James Otis, and he's in this room. He's bringing a case as a crusading lawyer before Thomas Hutchinson. Who's the chief judge, who lives in the fanciest house in town, and whose father was a famous government official, and whose grandfather was a famous government official, and who has all the powers and privileges of a kind of Boston Brahmin type a fellow. So Thomas Hutchinson is the chief judge. James Otis is the crusading lawyer who's going to later on coined the phrase taxation without representation is tyranny, going to be the earliest champion, along with Samuel Adams, of resistance to the Stamp Act, going to actually precipitate the Stamp Act Congress, where people from many different colonies get together to coordinate resistance, the first kind of united colonial resistance to Britain, and that's going to be James Otis's brainchild. So I got him in the room. He's a self-made Harvard guy. I'm a Yalie, but he's a, you know, these are three Harvard people, in fact, self-made Harvard guy. Thomas Hutchinson, the traditionalist judge, the crown appointed. And then I've got this utterly obscure fellow, also Harvard grad, self-made. He's 25 years old. He's just a lawyer, and he's watching this oral argument and taking notes. But he's very ambitious, and he yearns to be noticed. But at the time, he's a nobody from nowhere. And he's going to become one of the six most important figures in the American Revolution and the founding, along with George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Benjamin Franklin, and Alexander Hamilton. His name, of course, is John Adams. And John Adams is recording all this, and he says 50 years after the fact, that's when independence really began. And he's right about some things, and he's wrong about some things. I think he wants to remember it that way, in part because he wants to be remembered as there at the beginning, before anyone was talking about Patrick Henry, before anyone knew about Thomas Jefferson, before Virginia was seen as the cradle of liberty or something. No, it was Massachusetts, it was Boston, and I was in the room. And and there's a way in which he's correct about all of that. And so I want the readers to see the way in which he is correct, even though he exaggerates and misremembers. Two other related things I want, and over the next 15 years, a lot of the American Revolution is going to unfold in Boston, driven by these three people. Otis is going to rile up the Bostonians against Thomas Hutchinson, and they're going to riot in response to the Stamp Act and trash Hutchinson's house, actually destroy the thing in a thing called the Hutchinson riot. Hutchinson is later going to be, and Otis has riled up the Bostonians against Hutchinson. That's 1765, after the Stamp Act has kicked in, and Otis is thundering against it. No taxation without representation. Taxation without representation is tyranny. And then a few years later, there's going to be blood that is shed in Boston, a Boston massacre, and Thomas Hutchinson is going to be in the very thick of things as lieutenant governor, and John Adams is actually going to, the soldiers who killed some people in this street confrontation, and then still later, Thomas Hutchinson is going to precipitate in some ways the Boston Tea Party led by Adams's cousin, Samuel Adams, and there are going to be debates back and forth between John Adams and Thomas Hutchinson, and that's going to precipitate actually all of that. That's going to precipitate things called the Course of Acts, which are going to lead to Lexington and Concord and Bunker's Hill. So these guys who didn't know each other in 1759, really quite, or they weren't all in the same room together, in 1760-61, they're in the same room together. And that's interesting just from a dramatic point of view, a narrative point of view. But I also want the readers to see are two or three other things. One, in 1760, most of the Americans really are very proud to be British subjects. Britain is winning the war against France, and Americans don't see themselves as Americans quite. They're just British subjects. In the New World, and even if they saw themselves as New Worlders, wouldn't quite be Americans. It would be Massachusetts men or Virginians or New Yorkers. There's not yet a continental consciousness, and I want you to see that. I want you to see, the reader, when George II dies as King of England, and the word reaches America, right in the last week of 1760. In Boston, everyone is hailing and toasting their new sovereign, the new King George III, the grandson of the old king. And they are raising their pints of ale and proud to say, God save the king. They're absolutely loyal. And over the next 15 years, it's all going to unravel. So that's interesting. Just at time T1, they are proud. But people like Otis are beginning to agitate even before the Brits have really become tyrannical, before the Stamp Act tax, before the Townsend duties, before the Boston Massacre, before the Boston Tea Party, before all these coercive acts, and Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill, before all of that, Otis is starting to agitate, and the Brits haven't really done anything wrong yet. So I want people to see that, and they're agitating for one important part reason, because they can, because what has just happened, Montreal has fallen to the British forces. And now for the first time, Americans are beginning to see, at least in Boston, oh, we don't need the Brits anymore. We needed them when the French were basically threatening us, but the French have fallen. The Treaty of Peace hasn't even happened yet. The war hasn't formally concluded, but some Americans are beginning to understand, hey, like, we could be on our own. And you see all of that, and that casts a different light on what happens afterwards. It shows you the geostrategic context in which the American Revolution begins to unfold.
All right, so the driving force behind your book is about constitutional conversation. So could you briefly talk about some of the ways in which the founders conversed through letters, through legislative resolutions, through conventions, through pamphlets, through newspapers, and all the other various forms of communication?
Well, you just beautifully summarized it. I want the reader to understand just all the ways in which Americans are beginning to talk to each other in different colonies, across different political divides, and even with folks with their fellow British subjects in London. I want you to see the ways in which Americans talked themselves into becoming Americans, because that's not their initial identity. At the beginning of my narrative, they are loyal British subjects in the New World. That's who they are. That's Act One, Scene One. Even though it's before my narrative has begun, I show you, the reader, a great newspaper man who actually is beginning to appreciate the democratic possibilities of newspapers, which can reach a lot of people. And he's a brilliant newspaper man. He makes a fortune. He creates with a string of affiliated newspapers and a print and paper mills, because the big ingredient is just paper and ink. You don't pay too many people to produce your copy. They basically pay you to advertise, or you just reprint things that are freely available. The legislative debates that have recently occurred, a grand jury presentment, a recent judicial decision or something. So you're not paying a lot for content. It's paper and ink. And there's this brilliant business person, and he's beginning to understand, the newspaper business. And in 1754, he invents the very concept of a political cartoon. And he really creates the world's first proto meme. It's called Join or Die, and you've seen it. It's a picture of a snake divided up. It's a picture of America and saying, if the colonies don't actually unite together, they're going to be carved up. He's writing this about the French, because he's seeing a French and Indian war on the horizon. Now, he's a brilliant guy, and of course we know him as brilliant in other ways. His name is Ben Franklin. He's an inventor ultimately of the Franklin stove and bifocals and the lightning rod. And he creates a secular university, University of Pennsylvania, and he creates lending libraries and a philosophical society. He's an amazing scientist and entrepreneur, but he's also a brilliant democratic communicator who's creating the idea of a political cartoon, which is simple to understand, okay, for a democratic culture. Three words: join or die. Today, we would say hashtag join or die. It's a viral meme that he begins to see democracies sort of need these little slogans, no taxation without representation, you know, give me liberty or give me death or something. These little pithy slogans. He's among the first to do it. It's 1754. So that's newspapers. And Americans have more newspapers per capita by the Constitution's era than anyone in the world, even than Britain. There's widespread literacy, especially among whites, because people want to read their Bible. It's a Protestant culture. So they're newspapers with cartoons and letters to the editor and dueling op-eds and a lot of anonymity. So you don't even have to put your name on something. You send it in and it gets published, and people are talking back and forth across the political divide. People were more supportive of the king and parliament, and people were more skeptical. Different colonies, Massachusetts is beginning to talk to Virginia, across the pond, across the Atlantic. Americans are beginning to debate British officials who are trying to defend all these policies being imposed on the Americans. So that's just one thing, newspapers. And you captured other things. Oh, letter writing. Who else is Ben Franklin? He's a postmaster, actually. And you just got a lot of letters back and forth. And yes, speeches and courtroom oratory, as in James Otis in 1761 in this thing called Paxton's case, the writs of assistance case. So courtroom oratory, legislative speech and debate, grand jury presentments and pronouncements, correspondence back and forth, newspapers, essays, cartoons. It's just an extraordinary. I talk about paintings as well and other artwork. It's just and I want my audience to understand, the readers to understand, democracy isn't just about elections and voting. It's actually about conversation back and forth. I'll say one more thing. I mentioned the six big, the big six American revolutionaries, the big six founders. The first four presidents, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, plus Ben Franklin and Hamilton. That's kind of, I think, by consensus, by acclamation. Now, every single one of them actually, in retrospect, you can see, was a newspaper man, very media savvy. So Ben Franklin, if he were alive today, is Rupert Murdoch. He owns, you know, a string of newspaper outlets. Alexander Hamilton is a newspaper scribbler. He's an op-ed guy, you know, writes hundreds of op-eds over the course of his career. So, you know, he'd be like, you know, George Will or Thomas Friedman, just someone who has a regular newspaper column, but he's also doing all sorts of stuff anonymously. He gets to America because as a teenager, he writes something in the West Indies, just as for a newspaper, a description of a hurricane, and he's like 15 years old, and people say, wow, this kid can write. Let's send him to the mainland and give him a chance to shine. They actually come up with a collection. They take up a collection, the wealthy people in his West Indian island, to send him to the mainland. And Thomas Jefferson is a newspaper pamphleteer and essayist, as is John Adams. He famously writes this. Again, using pseudonyms, sometimes Humphrey Plowjogger or Novanglis. Madison is going to team up with Hamilton later on to write these newspaper op-eds, which we call the Federalist Papers. So all these guys are newspaper men. And you might say, well, Washington isn't quite. He doesn't write essays and things like that. Maybe not. But he reads more newspapers than anyone else. And across the spectrum, and he corresponds with everyone. He's a great letter writer and a good listener. He's really the listener in chief, but also he gets his name in newspapers more than anyone else. And from a very early age, on the very page in 1754, where Ben Franklin's newspaper has this join or die, It's got an account. This is 1754, before actually the French and Indian War is fully broken out, of this intrepid Virginia military man named George Washington, who's going into the back country of today Western Pennsylvania, and telling the French to leave because these lands belong to His Majesty the King. So Washington has gotten his name mentioned in 1754, 50 different times in newspapers up and down the continent. And you look at it today and say, oh, if you want to be president, and there's not even a concept of being an American president in 1754, but get your name mentioned in the newspapers a lot as a young person. See, Donald Trump has no tradition of public service prior to the presidency the way Washington does. But Donald Trump got his name in newspapers, at, you know, again and again at a freakishly early age. So this is a book about the early era of the American media. You're absolutely right. I'll give you one or two other illustrations of that. First, why was the Stamp Act so stupid? The Brits imposed a tax. They imposed a tax on paper, on all sorts of paper products, including newspapers. Now, they teed off all the newspapers because they're raising the price of the main ingredient in a newspaper, which, as I told you before, was paper. You're not paying for contents. It was just paper and ink. And now they're raising the price of paper. And wait, this was stupid because why are you making an enemy of the media? But the Brits aren't really seeing that this new democratic conversational media culture that's rising. So that's a different angle on the Stamp Act. It's not just taxation without representation. And it also intrudes in various ways. It's enforced in various ways that intrude upon jury trial, but also it's an assault in a way, or an imposition on the free press. And the press pushes back against the American press, against the Stamp Act, by just publishing their newspapers without the required stamp and making a big deal of that. So that's a media angle on the Stamp Act crisis. Here's another media angle. Why is John Adams the only early president to not get reelected? Because Washington did, and Jefferson did, and Madison did, and Monroe did, and they all walked away. They didn't lose. They won reelection, and then they walked away. Adams is the only guy who loses. Why? I say because he actually makes it a crime to criticize John Adams with the Sedition Act. He goes after freedom of the press, and freedom of the press and the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, these all grow up symbiotically. The Declaration of Independence is short so that newspapers can reprint it start to finish. The Constitution is short so that it can appear start to finish in newspapers, and it does up and down the continent. Every state constitution that emerges in the 1770s is once again short so people can read it in newspapers. So mine is a story of American newspaper culture being the indispensable matrix in which the American constitutional tradition is born.
When you talk about who the father of the Constitution is, or who really wrote the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights, the common thread I take away is your general aversion to great man theory of history, which would say history comes about through the machinations of a select few leaders. And instead, you view the founding fathers not as architects, but more as conduits within a larger established social context. And the social context, of course, is always going to require those conduits to be tangibly realized in the political institutions of the day, even though this can sometimes be a little counterintuitive to actually imagine. If I remember, you had the passage of the voice of America booming down from the heavens saying, "This is my idea," in which I'm well pleased, which I thought was pretty funny, and that in my mind just really goes to illustrate the point of America talking through the delegates and not the delegates talking for America, even though that can sometimes be hard to see in a literal sense. I know that was a little bit of a run-on question, but if you could address some of the themes in that.
It's a very sophisticated and astute reading of my work. For narrative purposes, I give you a lot of fun biographical information about some of the main people. So I told you, Act One, Scene One, I've got three interesting people in a room. And I tell you about Thomas Jefferson, and I've seen Thomas Hutchinson and James Otis and John Adams. And I'm going to have later chapters entitled Washington, Hamilton. There's a chapter jointly about Jefferson and Madison and Adams. And there's going to be a chapter about Andrew Jackson. So I do feature profiles of stories about biographies of the great men in American history, in part because that makes it more readable and real, and it makes it more human. We can, and especially the presidency, you see, revolves around one person. There's one person in office at any given time in the presidency. That's not true for the judiciary, obviously not true for the House or the Senate. So I do that, but my larger story is actually about the broader American democratic context and culture that helps nurture these people, helps create them, and selects them. Because they don't pick themselves. It's not quite like if you are a fan of the Netflix series The Crown. These aren't people who are born into certain slots. They are picked by a democratic culture. And the one possible counter to that is I do say that there was one person who really was indispensable. And maybe without him, you don't have the Constitution, and that's George Washington. But anyone else, if Madison hadn't been there at Philadelphia, I think the Philadelphia Convention would have pretty much come up with many of the same concepts because they grew organically out of an earlier a de more a decade of conversation at the state level, with state constitutions, and at the federal level, trying to figure out how to create a continental system that will work. The Articles of Confederation was an early effort that turned out to fail. So my claim is, imagine that lightning had struck James Madison on his way to Philadelphia. Most of the Constitution that we have would have emerged even without Madison, because it's building on state constitutional antecedents that are coming up organically, state by state, from the people, and being reprinted in newspapers. And one state copies another state, and then a third state builds on the first two, et cetera, et cetera. So if Madison wasn't there, you'd pretty much have had a similar constitution. If Adams had been there, he wasn't. I'm not sure it would have been totally different. Or Thomas Jefferson, let's say, instead of Edmund Randolph or something, not sure it would have been completely a different thing, because it's a reflection, the Constitution is, of state constitutions and the ideas that had been refined and that were emerging in the revolutionary period as Americans try to govern themselves. My one exception is I do think without Washington, it may be what maybe would have been hard to coalesce around this plan. The biggest thing about the Constitution compared to state constitutions, most of the US Constitution builds on the best features of pre-existing state constitutions. It's a written document, so where 11 of the state constitutions that emerged, that were crafted in the 1770s and 80s. It's ratified by the people in a special way. That's because Massachusetts did that in 1779, 80, and then New Hampshire copied that, and that's the best state practice. It's got a bicameral legislature. Well, so do all the revolutionary state constitutions, except in Pennsylvania and Georgia. It's got three branches of government, an executive, a legislative, executive, and judiciary. So do the state constitutions. It provides for judicial independence. So do the best state constitutions. it actually combines some of the best features of the best state constitutions. It's got an executive who has a veto pen, so does the best state constitution in Massachusetts. So it's built, it omits the Bill of Rights in the ratification period. People say, hey, dudes, you forgot the rights, because they're in state constitutions. That's one of the best features of state constitutions. Declaration of Independence says that governments are instituted among men to secure rights. So even when the framers made a mistake, America pushes back and we get a Bill of Rights that looks like state bills of rights in various ways. So the American Constitution really is a reflection of the best practices in the individual states. States as laboratories of experimentation, an idea associated today with a famous 20th century justice named Louis Brandeis. Okay, what's then the biggest new thing about the Constitution? It has a breathtakingly strong chief executive compared to states. None of the states had a four-year term, perpetually re-eligible, independently elected, with a strong veto pen and pardon pen. Massachusetts had a strong veto pen, but that guy was annually elected, not for a four-year term, didn't control a Continental Army. So even the Massachusetts Constitution, which had the strongest governorship, was just a pale reflection of the American presidency. So if that's the biggest new thing in the Constitution, it's not coming from James Madison, who doesn't understand executive power at all. It's coming from George Washington. He won the Revolutionary War, and he has the only army in the continent, and he gives it up rather than make himself king in 1783. And so Americans trust him, and he doesn't have a son that he's going to hand off power to. So he's not going to try to create a throne because he doesn't have anyone to give it to. And he's from the South, but he saved the North, Boston, when he went up as the Continental Army's commander. He really has spent a lot of time in the West from the 1750s on. As Ben Franklin informed his readers, he's more of a Westerner than Daniel Boone in a way. So he understands the South, the North, and the West. He's the embodiment of America. He's unanimously picked to preside over the Philadelphia Convention. No one's ever heard of James Madison at the time. They know Washington and Franklin, and that's it. And then the Constitution is designed in his image with a strong executive. He doesn't need to say anything at Philadelphia because everyone just follows his body language. Oh, he's smiling. Oh, he's frowning. There are only 55 people there at Philadelphia. They're not all there at the same time. 39 sign their names to the document at the end. But five of the 55, so Washington is one of them, and five other, and he's the presiding officer, five others were actually his aides de camp during the war from five different states. Hamilton from New York, Mifflin from Pennsylvania, Pinckney, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney from South Carolina, Edmund Randolph from Virginia, and McHenry from Maryland. So five of them were his aides. Half of them fought in the American Revolution, a third in the Continental Army. They give him what he thinks he needs, he wants, and then he's unanimously, people ratify the Constitution basically because Washington vouches for it. You know, if they're unsure, they say, well, Washington's for it, and Franklin also, but Washington most of all, he signs the document before everyone else. And pens a little letter saying, I vouch for this thing under his signature. And people ratify it because of George Washington, because they can trust him. They're willing to go along with a strong presidency, even though it makes them nervous because they trust him. And he's unanimously elected president. Every elector votes for him. He's unanimously reelected president. So he's maybe, and then he steps down again. He's maybe the indispensable man. But apart from that, yes, it's a more of a story organically of America. In this broad conversation involving lots of folks who bottom up generate state constitutions that are published in newspapers, copied in sister states, and refined over the years.
Thinking about two issues that were always in the foreground throughout the book, secession and nullification, which were generally used as pretextual arguments to defend and protect the institution of slavery, which is, of course, the greatest flaw with the Constitution. You talk about the jump from 1776 to 1788, and you juxtapose Washington, who really understood the important distinction between the two, then with Thomas Jefferson, who's off away at Paris and who never really truly got his mind off of 1776. So you can talk about them and just generally the importance of those two dates.
The most, if you ask someone, what's the most important constitutional decision ever? On the AP test, they'll say Marbury versus Madison, but that's not really. It's not even the most important constitutional decision of 1803. And note they said constitutional decision, not constitutional case. And in 1803, the Louisiana Purchase is way more important. That's a doubling of the landmass of the United States. Okay, so that's big. So, what is the most important constitutional decision of all time? Well, obviously, the decision to have a constitution, that wasn't made by judges, that was done by the people. The judiciary is third out of three in these three branches. So, it's actually not where the action is early on. Marbury isn't actually a big deal, that big a deal. It's interesting, but it's not the most significant thing. So the most important thing ever was the people deciding to have a constitution, okay? But after that, what's the most important constitutional decision of all time? I think it would be Lincoln's decision to resist an attempted unilateral state secession by South Carolina and a few other states. And that wasn't made by a court, that was made by a president, by one person. And that's eventually gonna lead to a civil war, and which is going to ultimately culminate in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, ending slavery, promising equal civil rights and ultimately political rights and fundamental rights to all citizens. And so, if that's the biggest constitutional decision of all time, Lincoln's decision to resist, after the decision to have a constitution, Lincoln's decision to resist unilateral secession, so he says, then we have to ask him, well, was he right or wrong? And my claim is he was right. And most scholars who have written about the revolutionary period aren't focused on this issue because they're not thinking about the Civil War. They're revolutionary era historians or founding era historians. And my claim is actually that this wasn't indeterminate. Lincoln was basically right, but he didn't quite maybe tell the right story. I earlier invoked the Declaration, I mean, the Gettysburg Address. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now he's saying that in 1863, and he's saying 47 years, 87 years before. You do the math: 1863 minus 87, that's 1776, and he's invoking the Declaration of Independence. And Lincoln, think, you know, saying the nation was formed in 1776. Yes, it was. But when it was formed in July 1776, my claim is that it wasn't indivisible. It was basically a treaty. It was an alliance. It was like NATO. It was like the EU. 13 different colonies that had been born at very different times. Virginia is 100 years older than Georgia, populated in very different ways by people pursuing different projects. Virginia's about Cavaliers trying to make a profit, and Massachusetts and New England are about Puritan roundheads seeking religious freedom for themselves, not necessarily for everyone else, but for themselves. Those are different projects. Massachusetts folks and the Virginians are not yet seeing themselves as one people. They're just Britons in America. They have their own colonies, but as late as, let's say, 1775, it would be more like the following. Okay, what does the British Empire look like in 1930? Well, India's part of it, and so is Kenya, and so is New Zealand, and so is Australia. But they just have a common crown, and that's about it. They're not strongly united to each other. That's Americans' conception. Okay, there's Massachusetts, and we have King George III, and South Carolina has King George III, and Virginia has King George III, but we're not strongly united to each other. We're starting to talk to each other with newspapers and all the rest of the conversation. And in 1776, I actually can read it from the Declaration of Independence here. Here's the key language, the payoff sentence of the Declaration of Independence is, you know, we therefore, the representatives of the United States of America and General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do, in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare, here's the key language, that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And my claim is they're free and independent even of each other. They, the Articles of Confederation will say each state is free and each state is free and independent.
Firm League of Friendship.
Firm League of Friendship. It's a confederacy. That was Thomas Jefferson's vision in 1776. Each former colony, now its own nation state, we're leagued together. We're in an alliance. Yes, we're in a league, in a confederation, like NATO, like the EU. But there's, in that sort of world, there's Brexit. We can, any state could leave if it wants. That was Thomas Jefferson's vision. And then he went off to France. He missed the action that happened in 1787-88, where, on my view, we created a more, we the people of the United States, a more perfect union that was understood by all to be indivisible. It was like a merger of sorts. And if you didn't want to join, you didn't have to, because each state is free and independent, and no state could speak for any other. So in fact, when Washington takes his oath as first president, North Carolina hasn't said yes, so it's not in the USA 2.0, and Rhode Island hasn't said yes. So Jefferson never understood, because he was off in France, that in this key year, the document was put to a vote in each and every state, special vote, and we created an indivisible union. And that's key to my narrative. I think that's the single most important question in all of constitutional law, and I think it has an answer. But until I've come along, truthfully, many of the greatest historians of the founding period haven't talked very much about that issue, because, well, that's not my period. I'm a founding era guy. And the debates about nullification and secession are from the 1830s or from the 1850s and 60s. So you're absolutely right. That's one of my central claims, is that Washington absolutely understood the need for an indivisible union for military geostrategic purposes. Jefferson never got it. He missed actually the Constitution, and he was a 1776 man, a Declaration of Independence guy. And the Declaration of Independence was actually merely a league, a treaty of sorts, a confederacy of sorts. So yes, 1776 is very much about 13 separate, free and independent entities. And 1788, the Constitution, is all about a more perfect union on the model of the union of Scotland and England, creating one indivisible entity.
Yeah, you briefly mentioned at the end some of the geostrategic concerns, and you talked about that again with the influence of the Federalist Papers, where you highlight the first few over some that we learn more today, typically like Federalist 10. So could you talk about those and then maybe bring it out larger to the argument you make about the geostrategic concerns being the important deciding factor instead of other accounts which focus on the debtor laws and Shay's rebellion?
Right. So you're an American. You might not describe yourself that way. You might describe yourself as a Virginian, South Carolinian, a Massachusetts man, a New Yorker. Okay. But, you know, what do you want? You want to be free. You want to govern, be free to govern yourself. And for you, government means at the colonial level, and now these are states. Fine. So you might not, and you look around the world, and you notice that there haven't been very many democracies in the history of the world. They've tended to collapse. And the ones that did exist were over relatively small patches of territory. Athens, 5th century before Christ, Periclean Athens or something, is a city-state, maybe 30,000 people. They all speak the same language. They all worship the same gods. And maybe democracy can be work on that sort of small scale. And now it's being proposed by the Federalists is one massive continental regime that they claim is going to be democratic, but the world has never seen anything like that. It would be as if today someone said, you know what, we're going to have a real world government. It's going to have everyone in the world's going to get to vote for a legislature of the world. And it's going to have a president of the world, and he's going to command an army of the world, and it's going to be able to directly tax everyone in the world for anything that they might do. And Americans would be very skeptical of that today. You know, why should we do that? My claim is there's only one imaginable thing that would ever get us to vote for that today, and that would be Martians, you know, men in black, aliens. And then we'd say, well, we don't really, you know, always agree with the Russians, and we don't always love the Chinese, but at the end of the day, they are Homo sapiens. So we need to unite. Let's roll. Let's kick some alien butt. That's the only thing today that could get us to, well, the New World is separated in 1788 by a vast ocean. It's a world unto itself, and what's being proposed is, in effect, world government. And why would you ever vote for that today? Vote for that back then, when the history of the world had never had anything like that. And my claim is there's only one reason you would do it, and it's not Federalist 10 and Madison and, you know, oh, he said, oh, democracy will work better at a continental level. But that's a very interesting theoretical idea, but it's just a theory. Here's why. And he said, oh, well, your state might actually have all sorts of tensions within it between creditors and debtors. So we should have a continental regime that will keep your state in line. And you're thinking, why do I trust these people way off in a continental capital? You know, if you're a European today, why do I trust Brussels, these bureaucrats? Why can't we just govern closer to home? So I say it's not about Shay's Rebellion in the end, or if it is, it's particular aspect of Shay's Rebellion, not creditors versus debtors. Here's why you have to vote for it, a more perfect union, an individual union. Because if you don't, you're dead. Join or die. The Americans were damn lucky to win the Revolutionary War. We almost lost it a whole bunch of different ways, and Washington would know. And the fundamental problem there are 3 million Americans and 9 million Brits and 30 million French people. And how are we going to survive in this cold, cruel world? Only by joining militarily. Who is free in the rest of the world? You look around, you want to be free. So let's look and see who's free and try to figure out why. Well, the only people who are free, basically, are the French free? Today they are. But back then, there's an absolutist monarch who sits on the throne at Versailles. Modern day Germany are sort of ruled by emperors and dukes and princes and the Russias are ruled by an absolutist czar or czarina, and the Chinese are told what to do by an emperor, and there's self-government almost nowhere on the planet except for Britain to some degree. Now they've got a king no one voted for, they've got a House of Lords no one voted for, but they do have a parliament and they have jury trial, so they have some self-government, and the Swiss. And that's about it. The Dutch are in the process of losing self-government. Now, why have the Brits been able to be free? Here's why, because they've got defensible borders. Because everywhere else in the world, and why the Swiss, they've got defensible borders too. They're called the Alps, and the Brits are an island. Everywhere else in the world, you have a land border, let's say between modern day France and modern day Germany. And the guys on the other side of the border, they build up their army, and then you build up yours, and they build up theirs bigger, and you build up yours bigger. And then the people in control of these armies use the armies to squash people domestically. That's the world. Land borders lead to armies, lead to strongmen, military figures, lead to no freedom. That's the world. How did the Swiss avoid that? Well, they got the Alps. Okay. How did the Brits avoid that? They created a perfect union between Scotland and England in 1707. Before that, there wasn't a naturally defensible border between Scotland and England. Hadrian's Wall is really not that defensible. And they're always fighting each other. And Mel Gibson is coming down and whomping on the English. That's the movie. Braveheart, and Mary Queen of Scots is intervening, and no one's free because you live in a garrison state. But when England and Scotland create a perfect union in 1707, now you don't need soldiers in the island because you've demilitarized the island. All you need is a navy that needs to protect you against the Spanish Armada, and navies don't threaten liberty nearly so much because they can only just lay siege to a coastal city or something like that. They don't threaten the hinterland. So we want to be like Britain. We want to create an island nation, Fortress America. And instead of the English Channel, we'll have the entire Atlantic Ocean. We have to unite, because if we don't unite, we'll join or die. There's going to be a military border between Virginia, between South Carolina and North Carolina, between North Carolina and Virginia, between Virginia and Maryland, between Maryland and Pennsylvania, or Pennsylvania and New York. And that international border will have armies on both sides, and Europe will come play us off one against the other for who controls the West, and we'll be just like Europe, and we'll the continent of Europe, and we won't have democracy. But join or die, if we can unite, now not as British provinces against France, but as American provinces, American states, even against Britain, we won't need a very big army at all. We just need rely on the Atlantic Ocean and a small navy that can protect us, a small enough army to be able to kick the Brits out, because they still have some forts, kick the Spanish out, kick the French out, frankly, kill the native tribes if they ally with European powers, control the continent, manifest destiny, the Monroe Doctrine, what will become Louisiana Purchase, from sea to shining sea, no one will mess with us, which is, now you're seeing why Americans say, some of them say, we want a defensible border. And why do we have to get involved in all the affairs of the world? Isolationism of a certain sort is built into this American geostrategic vision. That's the argument of the Federalist Papers that convinces ordinary people that if we can do this, we can be free, but we have to militarily, it has to be indivisible, because otherwise what happens when if one state just wants to leave on its own and turn its guns 180 degrees and point into the bellies of other people, no, it only works if all Americans invest and pointed the guns outward against the rest of the world, and they can't be just swiveled around by a local population at any point. That's the geostrategic argument for indivisibility that Washington, who's a military guy, understands in his bones, and Hamilton understands in his bones. Jefferson, not so much. He wasn't around, and he was never in the military. Madison, not so much. He was never in the military, but Madison is an indivisible guy in a way that Jefferson isn't quite. But Washington and Hamilton, more than anyone really, and Franklin, originator of the join or die meme, they understand this geostrategic argument for union, which turns out to then be the strong logic underneath the answer to the biggest constitutional question of all time, which is, can a state, having joined, leave on its own? No, it can't, because it would. And I told you that I was going to tell you one final story about Shays Rebellion, because a lot of people, especially on the left, think America is about class struggle. And I'm telling a different story. It's not about rich against poor, creditors against debtors. It's fundamentally, if you voted for the American Constitution, rich people voted against the Constitution. Some of the richest people at Philadelphia actually were anti-Federalists, George Mason, Elbridge Gerry, a lot of poor laborers or middle class, we would say middling folk, laborers in America's big cities in New York were supportive of the Constitution. The real cleavage wasn't rich or poor, which is what some people say. Basically, the closer you were to the fighting end of the American Revolution, the more you're actually going to favor George Washington, understand we actually need this for national survival. And coastal folks understand this a little bit better as well. They're more connected to the world, city folks. And So how do they think about Shays' rebellion? Not creditors versus debtors, and we need to create a strong federal government to smash the local farmers or debtors. That's kind of a Charles Beard, Howard Zinn story. No, there were people freaked out by the Shays' rebellion. Why? Because they thought that this insurrection was being encouraged by the Brits, who would then sweep in and divide America. And the Brits have all sorts of forts that they haven't relinquished, and Indian allies in the Western backcountry that are providing them military support. So to the extent that George Washington was focused on Shays' rebellion, the class issue was a smaller one. The bigger one was the geostrategic threat, because the Brits had lost the war and promised to leave the continent, but hadn't done so, and still had a string of 20 forts, garrisons, that they weren't evacuating. And until they do that, America is at risk of losing, should the Brits decide to try their luck again, or should the French decide that they're going to turn against their allies. Welcome to world politics. So yes, it's a geostrategic story that I tell.
What in terms of civic engagement might we take away from constitutional conversation at the founding, and in particular, the conversation that was really deliberative throughout the ratification process of the Constitution? Can we bring that today, or are we too politically divided, or dare I say disinterested? Because when I was listening to your interview with Jeffrey Rosen at the National Constitution Center, my mouth dropped when you said that some of your students don't like to read full-length books anymore. So what can we learn from the founding on civic engagement?
That, and it's embarrassing. We haven't always gotten better. They did some things better than we did. Now, some things worse. They really messed up on slavery. But they didn't just vote on the Constitution, which is epic. They put the thing to a vote up and down the continent. And more people got to vote on the Constitution than had ever been allowed to vote on anything before in world history. And that's epic. But they also conversed. They listened to each other. They didn't combat. No one dies politically that year. Almost no one is seriously injured that year in political combat or fisticuffs. In these conversations, you can actually see people change their mind. They actually listen to an argument on the other side, and they say, oh, okay, that I accept your explanation of that point. And some of the people who are opposed to the Constitution, they're not voted off the island. They're not bullied or ostracized. They're actually listened to. Their best ideas become the Bill of Rights. They say, hey, you forgot the rights. And they're listened to. And in round two, those ideas are incorporated into the project. Some of their biggest leaders, the people who oppose the Constitution, become future presidents of the United States: James Monroe, Vice Presidents Elbridge Gerry, George Clinton, Justices Samuel Chase and others. That didn't happen in 1776. A declaration wasn't put to a vote, and the people who opposed it are basically never heard from again. And we talked about that. That's why no one's heard of Thomas Hutchinson, for example. They have to leave America, or if they don't, they just have to go underground. They make some of them go to Britain, some of them go to Canada, some go to the West Indies, and the others just hunker down. So the American Revolution, it's a war, and if you're not with us, you're against us, and here are your choices: shut up or leave. That's about it. That's not the American conversation in 1788. We all fought a war together. We may have different views about how the way forward. But we're going to listen to each other, and even if you vote no, maybe you have some ideas that could improve the thing. And yes, it's sad, because in certain ways, I think, you know, we're not as good at that today. Now, we're so much better in other ways. Women are part of the conversation. We're more multiracial. We have an amazing communication technology that enables everyone to be involved. But are we as good at listening to each other or reaching across an aisle? I don't know if we are. So my book is a very old-fashioned attempt in a way to try to find some common ground, to talk about an us, the words that made us, to show that, and these weren't my forebears. You know, my ancestors were in India at the time. My family only arrives in the 1950s when, to repeat, I'm born in Ann Arbor, Michigan. My parents meet in the United States, actually in Ann Arbor, basically. Yes, I want this to be, I want to talk about, and I do talk about slavery. We haven't been able to do that today, but maybe we'll do another episode if you want later on. We can talk about slavery and other things. But so they made mistakes. But we can learn a lot from these folks who actually didn't just create a constitution, but created a constitutional culture that was all about conversation in genuinely admirable ways.
Oh, that's a great place to end. I'll ask you one last question to wrap up. Can you talk about writing this book in the middle of a global pandemic and all the resources you were able to use? And then I always like to ask whoever I'm interviewing for them to highlight some other books and scholars that were their favorite for whatever their book focused on.
Two great questions. Because of the pandemic, I had to do a lot of work from home, but here's the amazing thing. You can have access to so much more stuff than was true even 10 years ago. So I talked about newspapers. Well, there's a project called American Historical Newspapers, and it's word searchable. It's not perfect word searchability, but pretty good word searchability. You can find a facsimile print, in effect, like a photocopy of almost every newspaper every day in America before the Civil War. So you don't have to go to 30 different cities to try to find newspapers that are moldering that may or may not have been destroyed by a flood or something like that. You don't have to go to 30 different cities to find these pieces of paper. You can find them all on one archive called America's Historical Newspapers. You tend to need a university library card for that. But let me tell you about some free sources. Every letter sent to or from the Big Six founders, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, Hamilton, is online and word searchable at the National Archives database. It's called National Archives Founders Online. And again, it's word searchable. So you can find, you know, every letter that Thomas Jefferson sent to James Madison or that John Adams sent to Abigail or vice versa. And there's this thing called Century of Lawmaking, sponsored by the Library of Congress. And you can find all the early congressional statutes and stuff from the Philadelphia convention debates and various ratification debates, and it's all available. There are 29 volumes in a project called the Documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution, DHRC, and they're all online and word searchable. So you can find out anything that was said in this epic year up and down the continent, basically, all the newspaper essays, all the convention, the ratification convention debates, all the private correspondence in this extraordinary year where Americans conversed with each other about whether they should say yes or no to the Constitution, which takes me finally, and that's free and word searchable today, to my favorite history books on which I, you know, modeled my own project. So let me mention five or six of some of my favorite historians and the books they wrote. So there's the late Pauline Maier, M-A-I-E-R, and she wrote a book called Ratification, for example, which is, I have one chapter on ratification. She has a whole book in which she used the 29 volumes of Documentary History of the Ratification of the Constitution to tell the story, sort of state by state, of the ratification process. It's almost like a NBA series or a World Series, because you go from sort of, you know, game to game to game, state by state. And she'd also written at least two other, I read all of her books, but she wrote a book about the American revolutionaries, actually two books, one called The Old Revolutionaries and another called From Resistance to Revolution, which talks about Hutchinson and Otis and Adams and the Boston Massacre and the Hutchinson riots and the Stamp Act the Boston Tea Party and all that. And The Old Revolutionary, she gives a really interesting profile of Sam Adams, who is John's cousin. And so she wrote books about the American Revolutionary. She wrote a great book about the Declaration of Independence called American Scripture. And I have a whole discussion of the Declaration of Independence. And she says, oh, Thomas Jefferson isn't inventing the stuff out of his own head. He's basically distilling a lot of what Americans have been talking about. There are a whole bunch of documents floating out there, and he reads them and kind of distills them into one canonical statement. So there's the great Pauline Mayer. I'm a huge fan of all of the books. There are about 10 in all of the great Gordon Wood. I disagree with him. In certain respects, he tends to emphasize Madison's ideas more. I tend to emphasize Washington's geostrategic ideas more. But his book, Creation of the American Republic, is an amazing, he wrote it as a graduate student, amazing discussion of the early state constitutions, which I talk about, the state constitutions in the 1770s and 1780s. He writes a book called Revolutionary Characters. That's a compelling a joint biography of some of the great founders. And I try to do some of that myself. He wrote a great narrative book, Empire of Liberty, that takes the reader from 1789 to 1815. He wrote a book called The Radicalism of the American Revolution. He's written 10 books and every one is great. And I hugely admire him, even though I do respectfully disagree with some things he said. I have a lot of art in this book. And I was inspired very much by Gary Wills. He wrote a book called Cincinnatus, which was all about George Washington as depicted in art history. Wills also wrote books about texts. It's hard to write a book about a text, but Pauline Mayer did when she wrote about the Declaration of Independence. Well, Gary Wills wrote a book about the Gettysburg Address called Lincoln at Gettysburg. He wrote a book all about the Federalist Papers called Explaining America. He wrote a book all about the Declaration of Independence called Inventing America. So Wills inspired me, oh, you can write about a text and you can use art. And I pay tribute to my own teacher, my own college teacher, the great Edmund Morgan, who wrote really important books about the American Revolution in really simple language. He understood Washington's geostrategic vision in a compelling series of expositions, a book called The Birth of the Republic, and another one, very short little books on the genius of George Washington, the meaning of independence, challenges of the American Revolution. So a lot of great Morgan books. Morgan's contemporary, Bernard Balin, who was Gordon Wood's mentor, also wrote a whole bunch of important things that influenced me, the ideological origins of the American Revolution, which we looked at all these pamphlets, getting you to understand the conversation that people are having, the intellectual debates. He wrote a really interesting biography called The Ordeal of Thomas Hutchinson. So he understood Hutchinson was a key figure. I could go on and on and on, but those are some of the folks. Oh, the great Ron Chernow really, I think, brought Hamilton to life for me. He's one of the dedicatees of the book, as is Lynn Miranda, another dedicatee. And what I love about Ron's work is that it's so readable and accessible and brings people to life. So those are just a few of my heroes and my favorite books. You see some of my favorite books, you know, behind me here. And Luke, I'm so impressed by the caliber of your questions, but also I'm inspired because I do worry that folks in your generation, they read very widely, but maybe not as deeply. They're surfing the internet and they're on social media, but they're not engaging the big books, which develop arguments in sustained ways. And these books that they're for me, they're almost like my friends. They're companions. I spend a lot of time actually organizing my books and putting them in a certain order. It's like hosting a dinner party and who's going to be seated next to whom or something like that. And I sense that in you, I have a sort of a kindred spirit. Truthfully, you know, I've got kids of my own and they're not as into books as I remember being at that age. So thank you for reminding me and reminding the audience of how important books are for at least some folks in your generation. And
oh yeah, no, on that topic, I'm running out of space with my bookshelf because I've only got space for one bookshelf in my room. So I'm double stacking the books. So it can be sometimes hard to remember where some are because they're hidden. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, at the start of the pandemic, one of the goals that I had that I've been happy to follow through with is I've set aside enough time to read one book a week, and reading's always been really important for me. And with that, thank you so much, Professor, for taking some time out of your day to talk about your very important book, The Words That Made Us.
Thank you, Luke.